RunAsRadio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 79 with guest Michael Andberg, recorded Thursday, September 25th, 2008. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com.
This is Run As Radio. I'm your host, Richard Campbell. With me, as always, my co-host, Greg Hughes.
Hey, everybody. Richard, good day once again.
Here we are, doing the thing, having a good time.
That's right. Yeah, it's a nice, busy early fall here, and some great guests that we've had recently and coming up in the future. I know you're probably traveling about the time this is published. And
as usual.
We'll be meeting up in Barcelona pretty soon for TechEd, the IT Week. We'll both be there.
You bet.
That's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and if you haven't already entered, get into the contest on the .NET Rocks site to win a free airfare, hotel, and admission to TechEd Europe. And if you can't go this year, it's good for next year as well.
Yeah, it looks like a great show lineup. The IT Week has some terrific speakers, some that have been there before, some that are new. And, you know, being the security guy and looking at the security track, it looks pretty darn interesting. And sort of the built-in segue there is our security track chair for TechEd EMEA is also our guest today.
Yeah, it makes it pretty easy. Let me just go straight into introducing him here. Michael Andberg is an IT pro evangelist for Microsoft in Sweden during his 11 years, although this is an old bio, so I bet you it's 12 years now, at Microsoft. His focus has always been on the Windows platform and security at the technical level. He headed up the security track at the IT Forum in 2007 in Barcelona, and at the moment he's also covering as chief security advisor for Microsoft in Sweden. Apart from Microsoft, he also enjoys photography, piloting commercial airliners, and downhill skiing. I'm presuming simulated airliners, my friend Mike.
Yes, that's right. Nice to talk to you, guys again.
Hey, Mike.
Unfortunately, the real airlines won't let me try it for real.
Ah,
but it is the real real simulator, though. So it is the real thing, but it's bolted to the floor with some hydraulic stilts.
I just got an invitation to go in a 767 simulator next month, so I think I'm going to...
Yeah, you should really do
absolutely.
It, because it's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
and you will
that's
forget
cool.
that you're in the simulator, because even though the graphics isn't that good, the experience is. So.
Yeah. I know we talked about that before. It's just one of your hobbies. It's a lot of fun. And you're doing the security track thing again for TechEd.
Yes, I am. And it's as always, an exhilarating experience. You get to talk to a lot of interesting people from all over the world that either head up the product group or some of the products that we are covering in the security track, or people that are coming in as speakers or do want to become speakers in the future. So I get to talk to a lot of people that are in the security industry.
You know, Michael and I have a lot in common. It's, you know, we're both security guys, his love of airliners and flying, and I'm actually... I didn't tell you, Michael, but I'm actually doing my private pilot's license here in the United States right now.
Cool. Yeah. No, I never got around to doing that. I did fly gliders back in high school and early college, but nowadays I only fly the simulators.
Oh, great. A lot of fun.
So I'm suspecting with two security guys on the show, we're talking security today.
What would you like to talk about, Michael?
I have this talk that I've been doing for a while here in Sweden, and it's something that I've been thinking about for quite some time, and that is how actually security and the job of being an IT administrator, how they relate to each other and how they can help each other, and why security actually is something that should come into the process much earlier when it comes to making a buying decision or deciding whether you should develop it yourself or something within a corporation.
Sure.
And so basically this talk that I'm doing, I started developing it when I read through a book that's written by Michael Howard and Steve Lipner. It's called The Security Development Lifecycle.
Right, great
and,
book.
And for the people out there that don't know of the Security Development Lifecycle, you could basically say that that's the process that Michael Howard came in and created at Microsoft back in Well, basically in 2002, but after Code Red and Nimda hit us in 2001.
I remember that well.
Yeah. Me too. I was the only system engineer at the time working in Sweden when the press started calling. So I remember those two well. Basically, the thing was that back then we were a laughing stock in the security industry, and people really thought that Microsoft didn't understand security. And right. I guess Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer and all of the guys, the top executives, decided that we need to change this once and for all. And that's when they brought in Michael Howard to kind of look through the way we developed code at the time. Uh-huh. And they created a process that got the name Security Development Lifecycle. And it's a 13-step process that you go through. But sure enough, since it's developers doing this, they actually number them 0 to 12. So, you know, you can't count from 1. You count from 0. But this book, The Security Development Lifecycle, a lot of people probably write it off when they see it, you know, at the local Barnes & Noble or whatever, as something that's related to development. But I would actually say that it's more slated towards an IT pro or an IT manager, because it's not written with code examples that much and so on. It basically describes the steps, what they're all about, why they're there, why they come in a particular order, and so on. And it's not a very thick book either. It's only about, I don't know, about 200 pages or something like that. So you read through it. Actually, I was checking on the web, it's 352 pages. I guess it's pretty good then, so it seems shorter than it is. I should probably also point out the fact that this book is not only for Microsoft developers and Microsoft administrators. It actually covers things that are just as relevant for a Unix admin or for any right. other system admin. So basically, this book then outlines what we did at Microsoft to go from, Code Red, Nimda, Sasser, Blaster, all of those guys that hit us back in the early 2000s, to where we're at now, where actually Gartner and some other of the major researchers are basically saying that Microsoft is, at the moment, the guys to look to when it comes to how to write secure code. And I think most people will agree that we have come a long way since then with Windows Vista and Windows Server 2008. And it is a big difference from back then.
Yeah.
And without a doubt, yeah. It's it's been quite a change.
Yeah, it has. And some of it painful for some people.
Well, anybody who's battled UAC has had some pain, but...
Yeah, but at one point or another, we had to take that step because... I mean, if you go out and ask a Unix admin how many of those guys are surfing the internet as root on their machines, you're not going to find a whole lot of hands shooting up. But no. Unfortunately, you do if you go into a Windows room. And that's what basically we need to change. And that's what UAC is all about, to make people realize that you shouldn't be an admin all the time, but yet make it easy to become an admin when needed.
Right.
In any case, so what I did then when reading through this book, I started thinking, because I'm an IT pro guy myself. I haven't written code really since I was in college. But I was thinking, so how does this actually relate to me as an admin? And basically the theory that I developed and that I create my talk from is that the security development lifecycle should really be one of the major items on the list that you go through when making a buying decision. So when you're going out there, you know, getting quotes from other firms, it doesn't necessarily, you know, happen to be Microsoft. It could be any company that you're buying an application from or a system. And basically, you should put that vendor then against the wall and say, have you used any kind of security development lifecycle, and can you show me proof of that? It doesn't necessarily have to be the Microsoft-developed security development lifecycle. It could be another security development lifecycle. It's all about that process, about the thinking. Because for many people, and I think Greg, because you, Greg, always talk about being out there in reality, and when you're working with systems, and for a lot of people out there, you know, security is all about slapping on a firewall at the end, or maybe a password.
Right.
And they think that they created a secure system, but security development lifecycle is actually all about that. Already on that cocktail napkin, you know, when you're sitting in a bar discussing with a friend over a beer, this application that you think is going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread and that everybody's going to want, that's when you need to start thinking about security and really develop security into the product at that very time.
Yeah, it really goes back to all the mantras we have about, you know, security needs to be a way of doing things as opposed to little things that we do along the way, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And, you have to think in a different way. And unfortunately, you know, it's very hard to actually get security to line up with ease of use and maybe in some cases, your IT budget, basically. It tends to be in the opposite ring corner compared to all of the other goals that you have as an IT manager or CIO. But it doesn't necessarily have to be if it comes into the process at the right time. And that's what, you know, this is all about. If you develop your code with security in mind from the beginning, it's not going to be that hard to implement.
Not to pick on UAC and user account control, but our access control, that's an example. I mean, it's something that was bolted on and added after the Windows operating system was designed to deal with a specific problem, but a type of problem that probably wasn't all that deeply considered originally. And it's not a perfect system, UAC. You know, it can be difficult to use and it kind of gets in the way. But I agree. I mean, I think thinking about these things in the design phase and in thinking about the way that you do things is clearly the most valuable way to do it.
Yeah, it is. And it also gives you a very great understanding of what's needed in your application, what's not, because in some cases people tend to add features that, you know, they're cool or it's, you know, someone wanted it, but you don't really go through the process of thinking, you know, should we have it? Is it really necessary? Or is it just something that we bolted on because we could? And the problem is that once you start doing that, it's very easy to lose track of, you know, who actually thought about security for this particular feature, who has done the threat modeling, who has done any kind of thinking about what's the patching process like, are there patches, you know, who takes responsibility for making sure that this code not only is secure from the beginning, but that it stays secure over time.
Sure. Frankenstein code and Frankenstein apps end up walking and talking and feeling a lot like Frankenstein over time, right?
Yeah, unfortunately. And the thing that I think I can't remember, I think it may actually be you guys that have talked about that in an earlier show, and that is, as an attacker, you have the basically the upper hand by being able to choose which attack vector to use, when you want to use it, against whom you want to use it, and it's all up, you know, to your choice as an attacker, you know, who's your target that particular day.
Right.
When it comes to being the IT admin in this case, you always have to be aware of any kind of threat against any part of your system. You don't know when it's going to happen, where it's going to happen, by whom it's going to happen, and why it's happening. So you don't even know if it's an attack that you actually know about or if it's an unknown attack vector that you haven't heard about, you know, so-called zero day. So as the admin, you know, you always have the bad deal in this case. You have the bad deck of, how do you call that in English? You have the worst hand, basically.
Yeah, the deck stacked against you, I think, is the...
You basically just have to be agile all the time, looking out all the time. And the only way of, you know, this could drive you crazy pretty fast if you run your system this way. But if you actually start over from the beginning and start thinking about security from the beginning, you can secure your system in a much easier way. And if you know exactly which, you know, attack surfaces do this code have? Is it connected to the internet? Does it require elevated privileges or does it run as anonymous? Is there any chance that I could use a buffer overflow attack against this code or has this been covered in the code? I mean, look at all of those SQL injection attacks that we had the last couple of years. I mean, all of those, and most of the time, they're not actually a vulnerability in the SQL server that's used at the time, whether it's Microsoft or any other. It's actually the web code that's in front of it that's badly written, and that ends up hurting the organization. So just by adding some simple, you know, code to check whether the input is actually within a valid range will save you a lot of trouble in the long run.
You know, the secure development lifecycle is the what everybody talks about. Really, is some of us refer to it as the security management lifecycle, or that bigger picture, where it does impact, you know, how do you do IT projects? When do you make decisions? And how does security interleave in everything else that you're doing? You know, as you do your requirements, and then you know, try to pick a technology to solve your business problem. You mentioned earlier threat modeling, which is you know, there's threat modeling tools, a really great tool that Microsoft makes available for free that you can download. But again, that's something that it doesn't just apply to development, even though that's sort of classically where it's used. Isn't that also a tool that you can use and a process that you can use in the IT environment?
Yeah, I would definitely say so. And a lot of the things that you actually get in the application compatibility toolkit, for instance, can help you in reaching more secure environment, even though it's about compatibility. Because, you know, if you do the standard user analyzer tool, for instance, if you run that against your code and figure out that this one actually doesn't run as a standard user, you need to be elevated. That means that you have basically an attack vector there that may, you know, at one point or another be used by someone. But the thing in this case is also that once we're talking about security as being one of the enabling features when you're looking into buying an application or a system, that actually also means that you have to have the guts to vote with your feet and just walk away if the vendor can't prove to you that they've been thinking about this from the very beginning. And I realize, of course, that this is not very easy to do at some, you know, there may be applications or systems that you just got to have, either due to the fact that that's the only thing your users know, or that's the only thing that that can solve your business problem, or it may be legislation that requires you to run a particular system. So, you know, it's not always up at your leisure to decide if you can vote with your feet or not. But if you can, and you know, if you're in an enough empowered environment where you as a CIO have that possibility of doing that, you really should think about doing that. That, you know, if the vendor can't prove to you that they've been thinking about security during the development, you shouldn't run the software, because that's going to end up being your headache eventually.
Well, because that product's not going to have the necessary level of quality. Security is a primary and really important component of quality.
Yeah, definitely. And it's like, I mean, one of those issues that always comes up, you know, at different times is whether we as Microsoft, if we use undocumented APIs or functions in our own applications, and if that would give us an upper hand compared to our competition and stuff like that. But the thing with that is, and what people miss in this is the security implication of this, because we can't use any, I mean, there are some undocumented APIs in some cases, but they're mostly there for test use and for development and, you know, things that we do behind the scenes. But you don't want to use them in a production application, because if it ends up that, you know, someone finds a vulnerability in one of these undocumented APIs, and this comes to the MSRC, and they, you know, they can prove that, yeah, there is a security flaw here. Since it's an undocumented feature, they may just end up cutting it. Straight off, you know, they just cut it out of the code and they don't really fix it. They just get rid of it. And if you then build an application or a system on top of this that actually use these APIs, you're going to be hosed as a customer. And that's why we try to discourage people from trying to find out what they are and how to use them, because they're not meant to be used. And you should stick to the APIs and functions that are documented.
So I'm still trying to get to the IT guy's role in this, because he normally never sees an API at all.
No, exactly. But and that's the thing. I mean, they may not see the code, and they may not actually understand code as such. But once you leaf through this book and you look at the different steps, it's a lot about threat modeling and trying to figure out basically what your attack surface is.
Right. And it, I guess this is the thing that developers don't actually do. So as IT folks, it's smart for us to get that model together so that when apps are being built, we have this information. It's like, you've got to incorporate this.
Yeah.
Yeah, and really probably developers need to be educated on this as much as IT folks. But Michael, can't you also apply this? I mean, it's not just about code. You can apply it as you said, to vendor management or even to infrastructure design and security, network design and security, the same principles apply, don't they?
Yeah, definitely. It's like, you know, sometimes you get setup instructions for an application that mandates that you should open a port in the firewall or whatever. And then you can always go back and figure out, why do they need a specific port? Why do they have this implementation? Why don't they just use a standard protocol or standard port, and then we can use a layer 7 firewall to filter the traffic that goes through there or whatever? It's, you know, you always have to question the implementation of the system and then think about what this might mean to you. And so I would definitely say that it applies to any kind of IT process or vendor management, really.
Well, and it's the problem, of course, is sort of enforcing this. You may give a threat model to a developer, but you don't know that they've actually implemented it correctly. There's no real great way to instrument, is this a secure app?
No, exactly. Yeah. And that's why, so the security development lifecycle that is still very much in use and will be in the future as well at Microsoft, it gets updated every 6 months. Right. And every time we ship a project, we go through the process that we went through and figure out, okay, so did we cover everything? Is there something new that we uncovered that we didn't think about before? And that gets implemented in the next version of the security development lifecycle, really, so that next project will actually incorporate it automatically. And that way it's a process that lives and then it's updated and relevant also today and not only 7 years ago.
Right. Yeah, it's a continuous improvement process.
Yeah.
And Richard's point about, you know, not doing the threat modeling or using the threat model is an interesting perspective too, because if you think of it in terms of a true life cycle, I mean, my position on that has always been that the threat model is a document it's part of the requirements document, right? And it's always updated as your requirements change and the app changes, then that's part of what the documentation of that app. And it's also a living, breathing document that stays with the app and is just a mandatory part of designing and developing, you know, an application or designing and implementing, you know, a piece of infrastructure or a large chunk of infrastructure either way.
Yeah, and or really should be at least. Unfortunately, I think in many cases the threat model is something that's being put away in a binder in the basement sometimes.
Right.
And you know, people don't update it.
Right. Again, that's just going back to the idea that, you know, do you approach security as a set of things that you do or something that you do once or twice? Are you dotting I's and crossing T's and checking boxes? Or is it really the way that you do things?
Yeah, and the thing is that it might seem as a you know, tedious thing to do, and that will require lots of resources and money to get started with. But then again, I mean, while if you do the process right, that basically means that for one thing, you actually lower the chance that you get attacked quite a bit. The second bit is that, you know, if you do get attacked, you probably know which way they came in and what you can do about it. If you haven't done all of this work and you get attacked, I mean, you first have to figure out, you know, how did they get in? Why did they get in? What can I do about
sure.
it? And, I mean, you don't get to pick when they do attack you. I mean, it's probably going to be in the middle of the night or during a bank holiday or something else. And, you know, you get back to your system the next working day and find out that you've been attacked. And then, you know, panic hits and people start, you know, unplugging machines or trying to do things that doesn't really help. It really makes the problem just worse.
Yeah, one of the side benefits of doing things like threat modeling and having a lifecycle approach to doing security or everything in general, software development lifecycle that includes security, is a lot of the times, I don't know if what your guys, each of you, your position is on this or your experience, but my experience has been that sometimes it's hard to get IT people or developers to think like a bad guy, to kind of put yourself in their shoes
right.
and try to understand things from that direction. But that's really one of the many good side effects of like a threat modeling process is that, you know, it kind of forces people to do that. Some people are very uncomfortable with that, but then they can end up having a little fun as part of that. Also, though, is that the process of threat modeling, I mean, if I had a dime for every time that something non-security related was improved in the initial design or in a redesign in a threat model, I mean, you quite often gives you a chance to think a little bit differently about the business process and about the architecture and the way you're building it. You don't just get the security benefits, but I don't know, Michael, have you ever experienced, you know, non-security related improvements that have just been discovered because that extra effort was being taken?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, people just start questioning their own motives and you know, they really think through, do I need this? Is this correctly implemented? Is it used by the right people? I mean, there are all kinds of decisions that you can draw or conclusions that you can draw from doing this process. It's funny, actually, that you mentioned here just a second ago that it's hard to make the developers to do threat modeling against their own code. Because that's exactly one of the things that we found out when we started doing this ourselves. It's kind of like asking a parent to be mean to their children. I mean, they just don't want to do it
is.
Because it's their code. They don't want to attack their own code, especially if they know that it might mean that it gets cut.
Right.
If they can't figure out how to...
And there is an understandable and sort of natural mentality that is, you know, I'm a software engineer. My job is to make things work, right? Is to give me the requirements and you're telling me that it needs to do A, B, and C, and I'm going to build it to do A, B, and C. It's a fairly new concept to say, well, it needs to do A, B, and C, but it can't do anything else. And trying to, you know, it's the how do you know what you don't know kind of question that can make it a fairly daunting task.
Definitely. And I mean, people, once they start doing this, because that's in this book, there's actually a CD also with some tools and some, for instance, there's an include file for C coding. Because someone once told me, I can't remember if it was, well, it didn't actually tell me, I read about it, but it could have been Michael Howard or someone else, but I just read this, and it actually makes sense, but writing code in C, that's kind of like, you know, playing Russian roulette. Writing code in C++ is like playing Russian roulette with an automatic pistol. You know, it's gonna fire every time because, you know, once you're using C++, it's very complex and you will get bitten once or twice during the development cycle. But if you actually, you know, get bit while you're developing it, fix it then, you don't get problems with it later. And just one of those things, that's one of the examples that I use in my talk. And actually, I actually subject an IT pro audience, you know, they're not developers in any way. I throw up code on screen in front of them and I'm asking them to look for the security holes. Because that's just one of those things that, I mean, you probably heard it all the time, and it goes back to the old white paper, The Cathedral and Bazaar, by Eric Raymond, where he says that, you know, given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. And that's just one of those things that it's not really true, because you have to think about, okay, so provided that I can see the code, you know, you have to think about, do I have the ability to see security bugs in this code?
Right.
Do I have the motives? Do I have the resources? And if I do see security holes, what says that I actually do in a responsible way, you know, inform the vendor about this? Or I might just go to, because there are actually, we probably shouldn't mention names for them, but there are some eBay-like sites out there that actually deal in vulnerabilities, where people can sell and buy vulnerabilities to create malware from. And you know, people might be tempted to go to them instead, because, you know, if you get $1 million for a security vulnerability that you found, or if you get a line way down in a KB article where it says, thanks to, you know, Mr. X for pointing this out to us, you know, we would like to hope that most people would go for the line in the KB article, but some people are motivated by their wallet, and they will actually try to get money for what they found out. So, you know, you have to go back and look at the code, and actually, if you look through the way that we are implementing the security development lifecycle and the way we look at code, we actually, you know, do not think that just because everyone can see the code, that means that you will find all the bugs. We actually turn that around and think that if everybody can see the code, that means that there might be someone out there that's seeing a security vulnerability that you're not.
Right.
And that basically means, you know, you might get hosed by it. So that's why you basically have to, you can't think about code security is in a way that, okay, do I have any code security bugs in here and can I remove them? You have to write the code from the beginning, not containing them at all to begin with.
Sure.
And so you have to kind of reverse that process. And one way of doing that, and it actually helps you quite a bit, is if you look at, for instance, our latest security, our latest development tools, like the Visual Studio Suite and stuff, lots of those tools that are actually developed internally and used by our own product groups when they create Windows code and so on, they are nowadays part of Visual Studio. So anyone out there with Visual Studio can use these tools to find potential buffer overruns, overrun problems, and etc. in their code before they ship it themselves. And then, of course, you can't use the ostrich technique of just trying to hide your head in the sand. If you find one, you have to figure out, you know, why is this a buffer overrun and what can I do about it? And I actually do use an example by Michael Howard that I borrowed in this talk where I point out there's actually just a piece of C code where it takes two attributes to the function where there's basically two pointers to two integers. You add the two together and then you check the size, and if it's all right, then you go ahead. If it's not all right, you exit the code. And everybody thinks that this looks like really solid code, but once you start actually looking at the code, you realize that if you actually hit this code with, for instance, 0xFFFFF0, and then with 0x40, for instance, you'll actually get 0x30 in this particular example, which is 48, and that's what they actually check against. If this, you know, less or equal with 48, then it's all right. But the thing is that the reason that this checks out when you run that code is due to the fact that an integer variable will actually, you know, start over from zero once
it rolls over.
Yeah, it rolls over. So it checks out and it goes through, but actually you're filling this buffer that was allocated for 48 bytes, you're filling it with over 4 gigabytes of data. That's quite a buffer overrun. And this is the code that I use. You can find it on the Microsoft website. If you go to MSDN and check for Michael Howard and Security Development Lifecycle, the code example is right there. And he explains how it works. But it's just one of those things that's very hard to spot. And if you then think about, you know, a major software project where the actual variables might get defined in one DLL, addition of the two is in another DLL, the check whether it's checked out size-wise or not is in a third DLL, and so on. It's really, really hard to spot these things. And that's why, you know, you can't attack them from that direction. You need to take them from the other direction and just don't write them to begin with. But the code, the tools to find these is, you know, you can find it in Visual Studio. And a lot of these things you can solve by just, you know, making sure that you turn on all of these safety features and don't turn them off just because your code doesn't compile all of a sudden. Try to figure out why it doesn't compile instead.
Right.
Exactly.
Gentlemen, I think we're about out of time. The book is The Security Development Lifecycle, and I'll throw a link up to the Microsoft press page for it. Michael, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Michael. We'll see you in Barcelona.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure, as always.
You bet, and we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.